This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, July 27th, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. Coming up in today's program, human rights violations continue in Honduras, where the ousted president was once again stopped from returning to his country. Walmart says it wants to expand President Obama's health care plan.
There might be a calculation there that, well, if health reform fails, it was not our fault.
And we go to India, where a law to decriminalize gay sex faces opposition from religious leaders.
Are we going to respect our minority populations? Or are we going to say there is no place for you, get out? These are minority rights which have to be seen in that light.
All these stories and more after this news.
I'm Andrew Stelzer with today's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The North Korean Foreign Ministry has suggested that North Korea may be willing to re-enter talks with the United States about its nuclear program. The statement, broadcast on state TV, said there is a specific and reserved form of dialogue that can address the current situation, apparently referring to one-on-one talks with the U.S. But a senior U.S. official said today that North Korea's offer fails to meet the U.S.'s conditions for resuming talks because Pyongyang won't commit to stopping the pursuit of nuclear weapons and won't agree to re-enter six-party talks with China, Russia, South Korea, and Japan, which have been on hold since April. The Chief Supreme Court Justice in the Gaza Strip has ordered that lawyers must wear traditional Islamic dress when in court, meaning that female attorneys have to wear headscarves and a long dark cloak under their robes. The president of Gaza's Bar Association has condemned the decision, which is set to take effect September 1st, and says the bar's members will not abide by the dress code. Meanwhile, the ruling Hamas party in Gaza announced it will not allow hundreds of Fatah members and members of parliament into the West Bank to attend a Fatah election conference in Bethlehem. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
Over the past year, as both parties have been negotiating an Egyptian-mediated national unity deal, Hamas has demanded the release of dozens of Hamas prisoners from the Palestinian Authority's jails in the West Bank. The PA argues there are no political prisoners, only those being held on security or a criminal ground. Now Hamas says that unless its prisoners are released by the Fatah-led Palestinian Authority, it will block Fatah MPs and members from leaving Gaza to travel to the West Bank. Denying access of Fatah leaders into the West Bank would prevent them from attending an upcoming election conference for the Fatah party of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and would cast a shadow on the current round of national unity talks in Cairo between Fatah and Hamas. There have already been severe travel restrictions imposed on Gaza for the last 2 years by the Israeli government. Rami Almagari, Free Speech Radio News.
Scores of people have been killed in northern Nigeria as police are battling Islamist groups calling for Sharia law to be imposed. Sam Alakoye reports from Lagos.
Media reports say more than 100 people have been killed. The dead are mainly those shot by the Islamists and Islamists shot by the police. The violence started in the town of Bauchi on Sunday after police attacked the Islamist hideout, following reports that they were planning an armed insurrection. By Monday, the violence has spread to 3 other towns in northern Nigeria, where the Islamists burnt down churches, a police station, and several public buildings. Two Islamist groups, the Taliban and Boko Haram, are responsible for the violence. The two groups, which are opposed to Western education, want the introduction of Islamic law across Nigeria. The violence is the latest in a chain of religious crises to hit Nigeria, and the relationship between Christians and Muslims is becoming increasingly fragile. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
Some 150,000 municipal workers in South Africa's major cities went on strike today, demanding better salaries and working conditions. Davison Makanga reports.
South Africa has been rocked by wage protests since the start of the second quarter in April this year, including doctors, pharmaceutical and construction workers. Employers are citing the global economic recession as the reason why they cannot meet workers' demands. In Cape Town, police shot and injured 8 workers with rubber bullets after the protest in that city turned violent. In Johannesburg, South Africa's business capital, commuters were left stranded today as municipal workers marched through the streets to hand over a memorandum of grievances to the local government authority board. South African Local Government Association Chairperson Amos Masondo addressed the striking workers.
We are operating under very difficult circumstances, but many municipalities have difficulties. We will do our best to ensure that we arrive at a position where we are able to speak with one voice.
Meanwhile, trade union leaders say they will report back to their members a new offer of a 13% pay increase from the South African Local Government Association. The workers are demanding a raise of 15%. Davidson Makanga, FSRIN, Cape Town, South Africa.
The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, has suspended a $644 million jobs program in Iraq because of two reviews indicating a portion of the money was ending up in the hands of insurgents and going to fund jobs that didn't exist. The government hired the Virginia-based International Relief and Development Corporation to run the Public Works Job Creation Program. Former employees told USA Today that documents were faked and projects that didn't exist were included in progress reports. And those are today's headlines. For FSRN from Oakland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
Tensions continue to grow in Honduras nearly a month since the Honduran military deposed President Manuel Zelaya and sent him into exile. Over the weekend, the ousted president traveled by caravan to the border between Nicaragua and Honduras, stepping symbolically into Honduras for a press conference. Military roadblocks and a 24-hour curfew impeded thousands of Zelaya supporters from reaching the border to accompany the ousted president back into the country. Tim Russo brings us more from Honduras.
Late Sunday night, 300 Lenca and Garifuna people emerged from the rainy mountainside after a two-day trek through the rugged Honduran terrain that defines the Nicaraguan border region. The group had hoped to reach the border hiking through the mountains in order to avoid the military roadblocks installed 4 days ago that have strangled this border region. The group emerged in El Paraíso, about 7.5 miles from the border and site of heavy police roadblocks. Berta Cáceres from the Council of Indigenous and Popular Organizations of Honduras, COPIN, said it was a dangerous journey.
We've seen how the military has created a campaign to terrorize and frighten the population. It is terrible harassment, the reactivation of all of the structures that existed in the 80s, not only the death squads, but also the civil defense patrols. We were lucky not to encounter the military head-on in the mountains, just the police, who were prepared to capture us, but we were able to skirt through those checkpoints.
In El Paraíso, Saturday morning, the dead body of a 24-year-old male who had participated in the demonstrations appeared 150 yards from the military roadblock. The human rights organization, COFADE, accompanied the forensics team which identified the man as Pedro Mandiel of Tegucigalpa, who was stabbed 42 times and showed signs of torture. Some 3,000 people carried Mandiel's body, covered with a Honduran flag, to a police barricade where they denounced his death. Eyewitnesses assure that Pedro was last seen being snatched from the demonstration in front of the police barricade Friday afternoon.
It was 4:30 or 5 p.m. when the police came out here and grabbed him near the tree during the march, and they took him. We started to look for him because they told us that they were going to take him to the police station, and now he's appeared, thrown out there, dead.
Friday evening, ousted President Manuel Zelaya spoke to Free Speech Radio News on the border between Honduras and Nicaragua, surrounded by supporters that had hiked days to greet him. Zelaya commented on the Obama administration and sent a message to the U.S. public.
North Americans created a process for change when they voted for Barack Obama. Latin America is changing too. We want new laws, new constitutions, and the people want to participate in this process. Nothing will be able to avoid establishing a new mechanism for the people's participation. We want democracy. We don't want dictators. We don't want repressive regimes. We don't want politics at the point of the bayonet. We want politics decided with votes and ballots.
In Washington, Hillary Clinton called Zelaya's trip to the border region reckless and has called Zelaya to Washington for a Wednesday meeting. Yet in Honduras, despite certain regions of the country suffering near paralysis due to the popular resistance, the feeling is that a diplomatic and political solution is further and further from being reached. In Tegucigalpa on Monday, the popular movement continued in the streets, commemorating Pedro's death and in solidarity with hundreds still trapped in El Paraíso under 24-hour curfew. Teachers' unions decided not to return to classes today, and the movement vowed to continue to strengthen a general strike throughout Honduras in order to paralyze the de facto government. Tim Russo, FSRN, El Paraíso, Honduras.
Honduras interim president Roberto Micheletti appealed to U.S. political leaders and citizens today on the pages of the Wall Street Journal. In an op-ed, Micheletti said President Zelaya was legally removed from power after the judicial and legislative branches of the Honduran government found that Zelaya had violated the country's laws and constitution. Micheletti's words come as human rights organizations criticize his government for persecuting people who support the deposed President Zelaya. Some say the human rights situation is now critical in the border region between Honduras and Nicaragua, where Zelaya supporters are stuck between roadblocks. To learn more about the interim government's response to this weekend's events, we spoke to Suyapa Portillo, a research fellow at Pomona College. Portillo is from Honduras, and she's closely monitoring the political standoff.
They have basically blockaded the road that leads into Honduras from the Nicaraguan border. There are several blockades along the road. People managed to cross the blockade to supporters and now are caught between one blockade and another that, you know, so two blockades between the border and the road. And what's happening at this point is that they're not letting Hondurans who are between these blockades, not letting them go back to their hometown or even go anywhere to get water, food, etc. So they're just in this highway, starving, basically.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton criticized Zelaya for being reckless by trying to enter his country by land. She said this type of action would do nothing to help restore democratic and constitutional order in Honduras. What do you make of Zelaya's move? Do you think this was reckless?
I don't think it's reckless for a Honduran to want to return to his country. Particularly if he was the democratically elected president. I think his move, and you know, even the Organization of American States, that they said his move was justified because the de facto government refused to, the 7 points that Oscar Arias, president of Costa Rica, had offered as sort of a beginning of a negotiation. And if you look at those 7 points, I mean, they were so conciliatory to the de facto government that for Zelaya to agree to dialogue on these issues, I think, was a great demonstration of wanting dialogue and wanting to resolve this diplomatically. The de facto government refused. They said these are not negotiable because one of those points included the return of the democratically elected President Zelaya to as president and to Honduras, and they didn't want him to return.
The Obama administration did suspend military aid to Honduras, but some accuse the U.S. of backing the interim government. I mean, what do you think about the United States' stance towards the interim government in Honduras?
They suspended military aid. However, I think Palmerola, or Soto Cano, as it's known internationally, the largest military U.S. military base in Latin America, is in Honduras, is still open, and there are still military exercises happening there. They still have their U.S. ambassador there. So I think that, you know, while the United States has made some symbolic gestures, it really has not taken a firm stance against the military coup and the de facto leaders as an illegal regime.
What sort of role could trade sanctions or cutting aid to Honduras play here?
One of the things that the administration has said is if they cut all aid, it would affect a large part of the population. We do agree, I think, that everybody in the international community agrees that that would happen. However, it would really put the de facto government in question. This is a legitimately illegal government, and I think that, you know, to sanction this illegal government would be a very strong message.
That was Suyapa Portillo, a research fellow at Pomona College, talking about the political crisis in Honduras and the standoff between the country's two presidents. Walmart recently teamed up with some unlikely allies to call for employer-paid health care. Walmart is one of America's largest employers, and it currently provides health care to more than half of its workforce. Some Walmart officials want to extend health benefits even beyond what President Obama's calling for. Tanya Snyder reports.
Walmart's letter urging the Obama administration to require companies to pay for their employees' health care was as surprising for its co-signers as for its content.
SEIU, which I don't know if it's the largest union in the country right now, but it's one of the largest two for sure, as well as the Center on American Progress, which is a progressive think tank in Washington, D.C.
Josh Bivens is an economist at the Economic Policy Institute.
There might be a calculation there that, well, if health reform fails, then we can keep on doing what we're doing, which is probably not the highest road to employment practices, and we can always tell people, but we are one of the few corporations who are really on board universal health care, and the fact that it failed was not our fault, so maybe that buys them some goodwill even if health reform fails.
On the other hand, says Bivens, if health reform passes and employers are required to provide health care, the mandate might hurt Walmart's competition more than it hurts Walmart. The megacorporation is big enough to negotiate effectively with healthcare companies. Molly Brogan of the National Small Business Association says a mom-and-pop operation with five employees may not have that luxury.
If just one out of those five people comes down with diabetes or some other kind of costly and chronic condition, the insurance rates are going to skyrocket for that small company, whereas with Walmart, there are so many people among whom they can spread that risk, they're not going to see those kind of increases from just one person. So it really is just a completely different ballgame when you're talking about providing health insurance to a small company versus being a large company.
Brogan says small business owners often employ friends and neighbors, and they want to provide good benefits. If they don't, she says, it's just because the economic pressures are too great. Walmart's advocacy for employer-paid health care comes as a surprise for many who have followed the company's actions in the past. Labor rights activists have criticized the retail giant for paying for health benefits for just half of its workers, far below the national average of 65%. Megan Scott is the campaign director for Wake Up Walmart, a project of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union.
Many of Walmart's plans are simply priced out of reach for an associate making $10.86 an hour.
Scott says the health plans Walmart offers employees either carry high deductibles or expensive premiums. Company officials have openly suggested that it makes more economic sense for their workers to go on public assistance, and many of them do. Scott says about 13% of Walmart workers are enrolled in Medicaid. Many also have children on state health insurance and other public programs, costing taxpayers about $1 billion a year just for Walmart workers. Hence Megan Scott's skepticism.
If they do care so deeply about the health and wellness of their associates, and it is, I mean, it's the largest private employer in the United States, which means it's a significant cost. If they care so deeply about the health of those associates, why they would need a federal mandate in order to start doing that?
Walmart's surprises didn't end with a letter to the president. A senior Walmart official spoke over the weekend to a Latino audience in Chicago and announced that the company was in favor of employer-paid benefits for everyone, even undocumented immigrants. The UFCW has recently stepped up efforts to unionize Walmart workers, putting 100 organizers on the ground in 21 cities. They're hoping unionized workers will be able to fight for good health coverage, among other benefits. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
Civil rights advocates are praising the introduction of a bill in Congress that would restore voting rights to people with felony convictions. The two bills, introduced simultaneously in the House and the Senate, would allow people released from prison to vote in federal elections. Erica Woods is deputy director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice.
We're talking about people who have been convicted in the past, who have served their time in prison, and who the criminal justice system has determined they are ready to re-enter society and to come back to the community. Once these folks come back to the community as American citizens, they should have the right to vote. They have responsibilities. They have to find a job. They have to pay taxes. They are raising their families in the community. And having the right to vote and having a voice in the community really is part of that reintegration and becoming part of society.
35 states currently prohibit people with felony convictions from voting, even after they've been released from prison, according to the Brennan Center. This disenfranchises an estimated 4 million people. Over the past decade, 20 states have reversed their restrictions on voting and have restored voting rights for people released from prison. Instead of a patchwork of state laws, the new bill would create a federal standard. The legislation also requires people whose rights are restored to be notified their right has been returned. Opponents say the measure is unconstitutional. Hans von Spakovsky is a legal scholar at the Heritage Foundation.
The 14th Amendment of the Constitution specifically gives the states the right to take away the right to vote for someone who is a felon. And so if Congress believes this is a good idea, the only way they can do this is by constitutional amendment. So even if Congress were to pass this, I think it would quickly be overturned by the Supreme Court.
The Democracy Restoration Act of 2009 was introduced Friday by Senators Russ Feingold and Representative John Conyers. The measure has a long road in Congress before it becomes law. More than 20 Iranians died in the crackdown that followed the country's disputed June 12 election, and hundreds more have been jailed or have disappeared. Despite the unrest, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's inauguration is set for the first week of August, after which he will serve out his second and last four-year term. Still, the protests over Ahmadinejad's election continue in several countries, with people saying this is not only about an election, but about human rights. Rose Katapchi files this report from San Francisco.
Thousands gathered at the Civic Center Plaza in front of San Francisco City Hall. Many wore green, white, and red, the colors of the Iranian flag. Some of them Iranians themselves, some Iranian Americans, and many of their friends, with one uniting message: human rights for the people of Iran. The demonstrators say this means an end to the post-election crackdown and no military action on the part of the U.S.
People want change. People want to be able to express their freedom of speech. And definitely the government that's treating people the way that Ahmadinejad's government is treating people is not desired by the people of Iran.
When horrible things happen in the world, we all have to be aware of them as humans.
It's a people's movement, and therefore it will not be denied nor rejected.
This is the kind of courage that we need.
They may not be in the streets because you beat them up, you kill them, but they are everywhere else. They cannot rule like this.
Some demonstrators spoke to FSRN on the condition of anonymity due to concerns about their safety and to protect their families back home. Many more spoke on the record. Manah Mostatabi is with the organization United for Iran.
We've got demands, and we want to determine what the fate of the prisoners are and the people who have disappeared and are unaccounted for. And there are hundreds of them. We don't know what's going on there.
Mostatabi echoes the demands of many protesters that the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon should appoint a delegate to investigate the treatment of those imprisoned during the post-election crackdown in Iran. Maliheh Razazan produces a radio show for KPFA in Berkeley focused on the Middle East and has lived in the United States for the last 30 years since her generation overthrew Iran's Shah in 1979.
Where is my vote? Simply that means I want to be counted.
Another protester was San Francisco supervisor Ross Mercurimi, whose father is Iranian. He says a democratic movement is growing in Iran and has to mature organically.
President Obama is going to exercise restraint with the Iranian government, but that doesn't mean on a local level we can't be more emboldened.
And as far as what might happen next in Iran,
probably it would be a military government until Ahmadinejad's term is over, and then after that there is a hope for democracy.
Police said the San Francisco crowd numbered about 2,000 by noon. Organizers estimated 12,000 by the end of the day. Protests also took place in dozens of cities around the globe as part of the Iran Global Day of Action. Rose Katapchi, San Francisco, FSRN.
The gay rights movement in India won a resounding victory earlier this month when an Indian court overturned a colonial-era law that defined gay sex as a criminal act. While the ruling has been praised by the gay rights community in India and rights groups across the world, it is facing stiff resistance within the country from religious and nationalist groups. The ruling has been challenged in the Supreme Court and is the focus of a heated debate across the country. FSRN's Bismila Gilani has more from New Delhi.
Hundreds of members of India's gay community gathered on the streets when the Delhi High Court announced its landmark judgment legalizing homosexuality. They hugged, kissed, sang, and danced to celebrate the historic moment as the court scrapped a 19th century law that criminalized consensual gay sex. Indian gays, estimated to be about 15 million, won this victory after an 8-year legal battle. However, the ruling has not gone down well with some sections of the community, bringing out sharp divisions in attitudes to homosexuality in the Indian society. The verdict set off a chain of protests headed by religious groups demanding reversal of the judgment. Surinder Singh is a leader with the Hindu nationalist group Vishwa Hindu Parishad.
We are warning the government that if this decision is not reversed, we will launch a nationwide movement and we will fight the way we fought our battle for freedom. The person who has given this ruling does not deserve to be a judge. He should be immediately removed. We are going to fight this in the Supreme Court and outside the court. We will do whatever it takes. The people of India will never allow it.
Kalbe Rashid Rizvi is an Islamic scholar. He sees the ruling as an open invitation to promiscuity.
Homosexual people have been part of the society for thousands of years, and nobody ever had a problem with them. But what is being done now is allowing them to satisfy their desires in ways that are detrimental to the society, which is not acceptable. India is a civilized society and can never allow this kind of freedom.
Many fear that legalizing homosexuality will throw the door open for gay marriages, which will finally lead to breakdown of the family. But writer and gay activist Ashok Rao Kavi dismisses these apprehensions as baseless. He is annoyed that people are debating the issue without understanding it properly.
If I was given a preference even today, possibly because of this sort of thing, they are pitting religious leaders against us, they are pitting astrologers against us, they are pitting nationalisms against us. I wouldn't want to be gay. It's just that I am what I am. I can't change. I've tried. It's not that I haven't tried. I have tried, but I can't change. I am okay the way I am. We are also good Hindus, Muslims, Christians. We are good Indians. We want to be so.
However, human rights groups are supporting the judgment, and some have even launched a campaign to garner support for gay rights from the social circles. Human rights lawyer Sumit Bhog argues that gay rights are essentially minority rights, which the society must not deny.
The origin of homosexuality has troubled a lot of people, and there is no clear answer on it. The reality that we have is that some people are homosexual. Most people are heterosexual, but as a country, as a secular nation that is diverse, are we going to respect our minority populations? Or are we going to say there is no place for you, get out? And these are minority rights which have to be seen in that light.
The case is now in the Supreme Court, where it will be reheard and finally decided. The court has asked the government to clarify its position on the matter. But even the cabinet members have serious differences on the issue. The government says it will try to reach a general consensus and then respond. Bismila Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
And that wraps it up for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.